Jimmy, Jimmy Crane, Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd.
Hey everybody, this is Jimmy Crane, and you're listening to another episode of Improv Nerd, sponsored by Under the Gun Theater. Are you thinking about coming to Chicago to do an improv intensive this summer? If so, then I want you to check out the improv boot camps offered by Under the Gun Theater. Now, improv boot camps maximize your reps with smaller class sizes, a team of teachers, and a focus on practicing skills. They have a boot camp just for new improvisers and another one for advanced players. This summer, get into the best improv shape of your life with Under the Gun. All you need to do is go to underthegunthéâtre.com. That's underthegunthéâtre.com. This episode of Improv Nerd is also sponsored by the second annual Hartford Improv Festival, March 27th through the 29th in Hartford, Connecticut, featuring performances by teams from across the nation. For tickets and full schedule, visit hartfordimprov.com and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at HTFD Improv Fest. The Hartford Improv Festival is presented by CT Improv, an improv company with studios in downtown Hartford. For current shows and class schedules, visit ctimprov.com. That's SEATEAIMPROV.com. And also, if you're in Chicago on Saturday, April 25th, I'll be offering one of my award-winning Art of Slow Comedy one-day intensive workshops. These workshops are limited to 14 people, and it's already half-filled. So, to register and for more information, just go to my website, jimmycorain.com. That's jimmycorain.com. Oh, boy. Do we have a great episode of Improv Nerd for you today? But would you expect anything less from us? Really, would you? Just think about it. Our guest today is legendary improviser and teacher and a friend of mine, Noah Gregoropoulos. Been performing, directing, and teaching improvisation, according to the IO website, it says 20 years, but I think it's more close to 25 years. He began teaching at the IO in the late 80s. He took over for Del Close. Del was teaching his performance level class. And halfway through that class, Del passed away and Noah stepped in. He's been on a ton of house teams over the years at I.O. He currently performs with Carl and the Passions, was on Jazz Freddy in Atlantis, and is the only cast member from the original Armando Diaz cast that still performs on Monday nights at the I.O. We talked to him about what it was like stepping into Del's shoes, who he looks up to in improv, and what his favorite improv shows that he's done over the years. Now, I've known Noah for close to 25 years, and we've performed on a lot of groups together. I can just think of Jazz Freddy, Carl and the Passions, the original cast of Armando Diaz, Comedy Underground, Gambrinus, King of Beer. And I've always been a little scared of Noah. There's kind of like a older brother relationship that I have with him. And we, when we all started out, we all wanted Noah's approval, much like we all wanted Del's approval, or I wanted Del's approval. So if you could get a compliment out of Noah, it was a big deal. And Noah also has a way of finding my buttons, like an older brother, and pushing them. And as you'll hear in this interview, he tries to push some of my buttons. I don't know if I did a good job of not reacting or not. But I felt a little sad and disappointed at myself that I wasn't a little more playful with Noah in this interview. So you're going to probably hear me a little uptight in my voice. So, but it's a great interview. Noah has so much knowledge, and he's and we talk about it in this interview. We knew early on that this guy was going to be a great improv teacher, and he truly, truly is. Before we get to this episode, just keep in mind that we recorded this at the Northwestern University outside of Chicago, Illinois, which actually Noah attended. He was an alum, and he was a radio, TV, and film major. It was great for me to be at Northwestern because after high school, when I didn't know what I was going to do, before I got into the stable career of improv and podcasting, I didn't know what I was going to do. I was a total fuck-up. I was living at my parents' house. I was doing a part-time job delivering office supplies, and I felt so much shame because all my friends had gone off to great colleges and great universities, and whenever I would run into people and they'd say, what are you up to, I would lie and say I was going to Northwestern University. So Northwestern has a very special place in my heart. I think you're going to love this episode. Here's my friend, Noah Gregoropoulos. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd.
Well, you went, you were a radio, film, and TV major.
Yep. Yeah.
And you said that you would act in other people's film projects because you guys were either too lazy or too scared to go out and get people.
Yeah, so, you know, the other kids in class would be your actors, so... Hence the quality.
And was that your first experience in terms of acting?
No, in high school I did, you know, tiny parts in school plays, just to meet girls, you know.
And how did that work out?
Not well. I wasn't really committing to the acting. Occasionally I'd have to sing, and that was horrifying for everyone involved, including me.
And so when you were back here at Northwestern and you were doing radio, TV, and film, what did you want to be?
A radio, TV, filmer.
Which is?
No, I guess I had, when I went to college and declared my major, I was sort of interested in making movies. But the program sort of beat that out of me pretty. When I was here, the program here was very... more liberal or artsy than hands-on-y. You know, you made your little Super 8s or whatever, but it was mostly like, you know, Marxist, feminist theory of film criticism, and it was fun, you know, but it was just like being an English major. And I was not as committed to my major by the time I graduated as when I started.
So after college, you have this, you're working like at the dock at U.S. Robotics.
Mm-hmm.
How did you go from working the dock
to... Make it sound like I was a seafarer.
Okay.
It's a loading dock.
Okay, great.
Behind a factory on the near west side.
This spilled on me. We have water there, so just be careful.
Yeah, I told them to shake yours.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I can always count on you to give me shit, Noah. Going way back. So you had this shitty job at U.S. Robotics.
Yeah. It wasn't necessarily a shitty job. It was mm-hmm. just a job.
Okay.
You know, I was broke. I needed a job.
And then how did you get involved in improv?
Oh, these are both kind of shaky.
Yeah, yeah, it's gonna explode all over you.
Okay. Believe that. That'll be the shotgun over the fireplace in Act One.
Okay.
How did I get involved in it? Well, I was dating a girl named Mary Klonowski.
Okay.
And we were both poor. And she's like, hey, the sets at Second City are free, you know. So we went to one of those. It was funny. It was a long time ago. It was back when, like, man, who was still there? Maybe even Jim Belushi era, right? That far. John Kapalos was, like, the host or whatever. And it was fun. And so we went back the next night. And we were real impressed that it was improvised. And we went back the next night and... they used to lie to the audience and say that they were just gonna improvise the sets even when they were just working on scenes that they were reworking. So we saw all the same scenes improvised, you know, with the same lines and everything. We were like, what's going on? This is kind of fishy. So we just didn't, I didn't go back there. I was sort of, what do you call it?
Disillusioned.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you.
Is your memory going?
I left my vocabulary up in Chicago.
Okay.
Which would actually be a favor to all of you. But then she read about this thing, Improv Olympic, which was back at Cross Currents, which is no longer there now. It's the extension of the Belmont L station is now where that used to be. And went and saw a show there. And the Herald was even sloppier than it is now. It was a bloody mess, and I loved it because it was obvious. There's no way you're going to mistake this for scripted material.
Do you remember who you saw?
It was like watching a riot, imagining it was choreographed.
Right. Do you remember who you saw?
What?
Do you remember who you saw?
I saw a lot of people that I still know, but the one who made me want to come back was Dave Pasquese, who's sort of back at IO now doing TJ and Dave. But he was just a young buck then. And I just remember, wow, that guy is really smart. clearly no one's telling him what to do. He's doing what he wants. This looks like fun. And I would have probably let it go at that, but Mary really said, you got to get it back. Those days, Sharna would host the shows, and she'd shill classes at the end of them, mm-hmm. sell classes. And she said she took down the number and made me go start taking classes. So thank you, Mary, wherever you are.
Right. And then, as I remember, Sharna would tell the story. When you first, because now you have this really booming voice, but one note that she would always give you was you were too quiet.
Yeah. Well, I'm still a little too quiet, but I push it. No, you know, I try to project a bit more. So yell, I can't hear you if you can't hear me during this, and I'll be louder. But also my voice will it'll just park right in the same frequency as the HVAC sometimes. And Sharna loses me completely when I do that. I might as well just be moving my mouth. So
what were those early days at the Improv Olympic?
Well, it was fun because nobody would go. So it was really, really counterculture. You know, there'd be three teams and two would watch the third one. But it was like heady. It was very, you know, it was very counterculture. There were a lot of drugs and loose liaisons, etc.
What are loose liaisons?
People were fucking around.
Okay. But you never partook in the drug part.
I was always swinging and missing.
Okay.
But there was a lot of shenanigans.
Okay.
In those days, and it was fun, you know, because it was, you know, Del Close young and Del Close and experimental. In all kinds of ways, and it was fun being part of something that you felt like you were in a clubhouse, you know, that not a lot of people knew about. And it was great that it got successful, because it wouldn't still be around if it didn't. But I sometimes miss the sloppiness of those days.
What did you learn from Del?
I learned from Del that everything's connected. He had a Catholic view. And not in the religious sense, but in the all-inclusive sense of the world. And it was interested in everything, and everything mattered. And I like when the work takes that point of view and isn't trying to be super linear or messagey, but it's, you know, the whole world is available to you, and it's related in all kinds of unexpected ways. You know, the whole life is a slow herald thing.
Did you, like, because Del was like such a... intimidating figure. Were you ever intimidated by him?
I guess I was always a little intimidated by him, but I also got along reasonably well with him. We weren't ever friends, but we were neighbors.
I don't think Del had any friends. Do you?
Yeah, Sharna.
Okay.
just because she had the nearest... He wasn't allowed to have a telephone because he was worried that he would make threatening calls to the president. It was with Reagan administration. So Sharna would just feel his phone calls at her house. She lived across the street from us, and we both lived on the same side of the street. So just by coincidence. None of these people knew Del, but he was... Del's classes were not like classes nowadays. Basically, Del would just talk for about an hour about... anything he'd been doing, anything he'd been reading, anybody he'd been hanging out with, some drug experience or anything.
It was like he was released from prison.
Yeah.
Remember that? It was like everything he had saved up from that for that whole week, he would come and just... Yeah.
And then he'd go, well, let's improvise about that or something. And they weren't like necessarily hardcore lessons. It was more like, I've been wondering what it would be like to... that's how Delta spoke. What it would be like to improvise in italics. And then wouldn't tell us what that meant, technically or procedurally, and we'd go up and try it. And it was actually a wonderful time. Because I always used to say that Sharna taught me how to improvise, and Del taught me why to improvise. And those are the only two teachers I had at any... I mean, I had a half a session with Herzl before he quit, and half with Mick, but that was about it.
Right, and I think people have to understand, in those days, it was two levels. It was Sharna and Del.
Over and over again.
Over and over again. And then also, you didn't even finish level one, and that you were on a team.
Yeah, yeah, by the time you got to week 8, you were either probably on a team or running for recover.
Or it was your third team that they broken up,
yeah,
you know?
Right.
You know, the thing that I love about you, Noah, and we've done many shows together, is you really love improv. It's an art form to you, and you're not interested in being famous.
I think it's kind of a cop-out for me to say I'm not interested in being famous. I don't put any effort into being famous. It's not like, oh, that's beneath me to be famous and successful. That lets me off the hook of being so lousy in auditions. But it hasn't been a focus.
But the thing is...
Did that undermine your whole line of
questioning? No, it didn't. It didn't at all.
We have to go to a different page.
No, we're fine.
You've really done your homework. That's the most you've written on a piece of paper since you wrote your 8-page book.
Yes. I'm writing a new one, and I think it's going to be 12. So, okay. And if you write the foreword, it'll be 13.
I'll try the foreword, 50.
This whole thing about fame, because yeah, we've seen a lot of people go on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we could name drop, but we don't have time.
Oh, let's.
Okay.
No.
Okay. Sure. We could name drop, but we're not going to. What do you think we've lost in terms of improvisation, in terms of the art form, because people come to classes now, they have their stars in their eyes and stuff like that?
Well, your question is loaded that we've lost something. I think it's changed. I don't know that that's necessarily a loss. I think it is rarer to have someone who is a non-performer just doing it to do it. Although I don't know if that's true at the lower, at level one, because, you know, it's a lot farther away now. By the time I have students, they've been hanging around for 12 or 14 months already. So it's just like junior college. So, I mean, I don't know that we've lost anything. It's just different because it's bigger, and because expectations are there, because people from here have had success. You get to that looking at the horizon instead of the road you're on, and you know you get hit by a car.
The other thing that I've always had a lot of respect for you is that. Regardless of who the director or the coach was that we were working with, first of all, you were always very respectful, and you were willing to take what they suggested, not only in rehearsals, but the next day at a show, you would apply that. Where did that come from?
I think that came from my experience at Northwestern, oddly enough. I think that when you're in the arts, turned into education, there's always this weird, you know, the isms and the schools of thought. And here at the time, I don't know if it's still that way here, there was, oh my God, the auteurist critics and the genre critics. They'd have fights in the street, and the video people and the film people. Picking one of those to be right or wrong is a waste of your time and attention artistically, but whoever you're working with, immerse yourself in what they're doing and see what you get out of it, is the only way to get anything out of it. Because otherwise you arm yourself with your beliefs about the arts, which can just make you close-minded. And I don't think there's much use in that.
Well, I always thought in the early days when we were working, we kind of traveled with a pack of people, like, if they don't do it the way I.O. does it, there's something wrong with what they're doing.
Well, we were assholes. you know, I think we know.
Right.
I don't think we're kidding anyone.
But where did that come from? You think just...
Well, you know, you're 20-something, you're still kind of a retard. You know, and you want to be right. You want to be, you know... It's the same thing that makes people join ISIS. You know? You want to belong to something and flex your muscle, but it's all pretty stupid.
Because I look back at those days, and had I been more open-minded, and I would have probably learned more.
Possibly. But this isn't about you, Jimmy.
It is not about me. You are one of the most respected improv teachers around. What makes a good improv teacher?
I don't know. I've only had two. So they were very different, right? Sharna knew her shit, and Del was fascinating. You know, those are two good things.
What have you borrowed from them? You don't talk for an hour, do you, at the top?
No.
Okay.
No, I talk for an hour after about one scene. No. I try not to talk quite as much, but you can't help it, son of a professor. I think as long as... See, there are so many different types of teachers, and they all do different things, and I don't really know what makes a good improv teacher. I'm not an improv teacher critic. I'm an improv teacher.
And I remember, too, like, when I'll never forget this. We were in Nashville.
Oh, my God.
Do you remember this?
You remember that. Because you were drinking back then.
I was drinking a lot back then. I drank through the whole weekend. It was the first...
He was a monumental drinker before he turned 25. And then he just went cold turkey, and he's still in AA, right? Or now you run it.
Yeah.
You're, like, in charge of AA?
Let me just say this. I want to say this. You were teaching back then. Do you remember this? And you were like this, you were great. Everybody said, no one's a great teacher, no great teacher, no great teacher. And you resisted it. Was part of that resistance, you know, my dad's a teacher, my mom was an art teacher. You didn't want to embrace that. I really think it was a gift.
I just didn't want to, I would not be that interested in teaching if I wasn't an improviser. And so I didn't want to necessarily be in the labeled as teacher. Teaching's my job, it pays the bills, but I'm an improviser first and foremost.
So even today, even though teaching pays way more than improvising, you're an improviser.
Improvising doesn't pay anything.
When people say, what does truth in comedy mean? What does it mean to you?
It means a couple of different things. One is, if you think of your memory as a source as opposed to your imagination. I know that sounds, you know, anti-creative, but I think it's the kind of specifics, the kind of details, the kind of emotional attachment you have to stuff when you are taking things from life and memory, it's going to probably go a little deeper than when you're pretending to be an alien and climbing Mount Rushmore's gnomes or whatever, which is fine, you know, but usually that's more clowning than even anything else. And then the other side of it is finding moments where your emotional reaction to both the person you're on stage with and the created fictional moment are truthful, simple emotional honesty, right, in those. And those are a little rare. Apparently we're about to go off. That's our guy. Someone needs a different ringtone. That's anyway. Those two things. I mean, I think that you can play an absurd situation honestly, and I think you can bring your own experience to the stage. And I think that's, to me, that's more interesting than just making shit up.
Have we lost some of that?
Jimmy, I don't know that we've lost anything. Have you been to TJ and Dave recently?
Well, TJ and Dave is like the pinnacle.
Sure. But there's a lot of good players.
Mm-hmm.
I see people do good work all the time. I think that you can get overrun by hubbub very easily. Because there's an aggressiveness in any group of people trying to accomplish something. People sometimes play competitively when I think they would do better to play collaboratively. But, you know, boys will be boys.
It has become more competitive over there since we were there. Would you agree to that? In terms of making a Herald team.
Far fewer people. It wasn't automatic. Even when I started teaching 5B, which means there already were six levels, you were pretty much already on the team by the time I saw you. So I didn't even have to think about that. Now it's, and I'm probably speaking to the choir, because probably half this audience are 5B students tonight in a class of 60, maybe 10 or 12 or 15 are going to get on a team. And probably 50 of them are probably good enough to.
So they're in 5B with you, right? Now there's a competitive nature to this that we didn't experience.
Not in class, though.
Doing the show?
Not necessarily. I think they're just having fun. I mean, I think they want to do well, but I think they get that, you know, playing together, they're going to do better than fighting each other.
So what is the committee, the Herald Committee looking for?
The Herald Commission.
The Herald Commission. What are they looking for?
Well, apparently those lights are on a timer.
The lights just went up. And,
whatever
oh,
that
there we
beeping
go.
Was, James.
What is the Herald Commission looking for someone who's in 5B?
You'd have to ask them that. I'm not on the Herald Commission, and I don't know who is besides Greg Euler.
Okay, and you have nothing to do with, someone auditions, they were just in 5B with you, and they come to you and say, hey, Noah, I didn't get on a team.
No, auditions are a separate, they watch the 5B shows. There's usually at least, I don't know, 2 or 3 people from the Herald Commission watching every week the 5B shows. And they know who people are anyway, because it's made up of mostly like teachers and performers who are around the building, so they know who people are. And then there are auditions every, and these kids probably know more about this, there's auditions every year, right?
October.
Yeah.
Here and there,
they announce them or something, and I never know they're happening until after they're over.
Because you purposely just like, you are not going to get involved with the politics, any of that.
No, I try to stay out of it.
How are you able to do that?
By doing it. It's the same way everyone is able to do everything. I just don't get involved. I don't go bark up anybody's tree about students.
But that's always been your personality, I think.
Okay.
I mean, you've always had like this great detachment, you know.
Okay.
And been very objective and
yeah.
You've done tons of shows, tons of improv shows.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the best shows you've done? And it doesn't have to be like the most popular ones or...
The best, obviously Jazz Freddy was great.
What made Jazz Freddy so great for you?
Well, at the time, I really hadn't done anything but Harold shows. And Jimmy was also in Jazz Freddy, maybe full disclosure. It was a bunch of people who... were from this group, Ed, and a bunch of people from I.O. got together and did a show in a theater as opposed, at that time improv was pretty much always in bars or music venues. And Ed had done shows like at the Remains and at Victory Gardens and produced the shows at, like they produce a play and put that and it got a lot of attention. And it felt good because it was incredibly well attended. And it was just a good group of people, and it was just good. The first year of Armando was pretty special.
What was special about that year?
Well, just a lot.
Because I was in there too.
I still like Armando. It was unusual then because most of the people in it weren't performing any other days in improv. That was the only time you could see a lot of those people do improv. So it was kind of like seeing Dave on Wednesdays. You know, Dave Pasquese is pretty much the only time you're going to see him improvise most of the year. So it's kind of special because of that.
And you're the oldest member. You're still got to be the oldest original member of Armando, right?
Well, I was in the first one, so
right,
can't
right.
get any older than
yeah.
that.
Yeah. How has it changed?
It's the cast is usually a little smaller. When it started, Armando was the monologist.
Armando Diaz, who's now at the Magnet.
Is it the Magnet?
Yep.
He actually did the monologues every week for about the first, I don't know, 6 months. Like maybe it was less than that. Mm-hmm. It seemed like about 6 months. And then we opened it up to the cast because he didn't want to do it anymore. So that was different. You know, one of the concerns when we first put it together was like, man, we got 10 pounds of ego in a 5-pound bag, possibly.
Uh-huh.
you know, which didn't work, wind up being an issue, but, you know, that was a concern going in. You had all these people who would, you know, but were doing the main stage, and at that time that seemed like a big deal. Now it's not so much. So it's like having to put all the status on someone who wasn't in the cast, sort of put everybody rowing in the same direction in a cool way. And it still does, just the given the status to, even if someone who normally is part of the ensemble, is just has that position for the night, you take, you know, you park it by the door and let them have the night, and that's, it's kind of liberating.
You have played with different generations of improvisers.
Yeah.
How do you, you know, you...
What have we lost?
No. How have you...
Jimmy wants me to say, since he stopped performing over there, it's really gone down.
How do you... What do you learn from each generation? How do you stay relevant? Because people will say, improv, it's for young people.
It probably is. I mean, I'm old, but I've been doing it since I was, 27? So it's okay for me, but people who start at my age have a hard time with it. They have a hard time taking their walls down, because you build them up over time. And improv reminds you to take your clothes off again and again and again on stage and be naked. And that's not easy to do, especially when you're 20 years older than the next oldest person on the team you're playing with.
Which is true, right?
We run a pretty broad spectrum, you know. Linda's in her 40s, TJ is, Shad has got, you know.
Shad Kunkel?
Shad's got a wife and two kids now, mm-hmm. right? But, you know, then we got youngsters as well. Johnny, who just left, was 19 when he started playing with us, John Reynolds.
And Carl and the Passions.
Yeah.
So what is it that you still like about improvising?
I like being in a creative situation where there are no middlemen. You grow to hate middlemen and as you get, you know, I'm not going to say I've had some success, but, you know, working in Hollywood and stuff like that, there's always a million hands on the product, and not always in a good way, not in a necessarily collaborative way, but in a fear, control, et cetera, type of way. Whereas nobody can do anything to an improv show till it's over. I can get kicked out of the building till the lights go off. So I don't feel like there's anything that I can't explore on an improv stage. And I find that intoxicating, in my case, quite literally. And I don't want to lose that. And that's why I don't try to get paid to improvise, because I think if someone paid me, they'd have a right to tell me what to do.
But you have gotten paid to improvise.
Yeah, but those haven't been my most satisfying improv experiences. I mean, I got paid. I made $900 doing a 30-minute show in New Zealand. $900 U.S. after we paid off the producer and because we were trying to get out of the show. I was touring with this show called Modern Problems in Science. We played rooms a lot like this one because we were pretending to be college professors and. And it was like an hour-long short form, in my opinion. It was a total gimmick, but the Brits liked it because it had a lot of wordplay. And this guy from the Postmasters Union of New Zealand wanted us to spend an extra, to fly back to New Zealand from Australia, and he put us up, and he'd have us do this show in a private room for the postmasters. And how many, you know, New Zealand has more sheep than people. How many postmasters can they have? So it's a room with like 20 people in it, sitting at banquet tables. And we didn't want to do it, so we gave him a price that we thought would make him say, nah, it's too expensive. So we asked for £2,000, which at the time was close to $3,000. And after we paid off our producer back in London, we each cleared $900 for a 30-minute long.
And you didn't think it was gratifying at all?
Oh, the money was very gratifying. Uh-huh. But the show was a steaming turd. That was gratifying because of the travel and meeting people. I met great people. I got to be friends with, like, Simon Pegg, who does all the movies now, and Bill Bailey. And what's this thingless guy? Rich Hall. all the comedians go on the same sort of tour around fringes and things like that. So it was fun getting to know people on the road, and listening to all the funny accents.
Great. So we're going to improvise now.
All right.
Okay. Are you ready?
Right. Yeah.
Okay. So what would you like to do?
A scene?
Okay, great. How do you want to start? You want to just take a suggestion?
Okay, you say you're late. No. Yeah, we can just take a suggestion.
Do people ever take your humor the wrong way?
Yeah. In email, it's never obvious that I'm
right.
kidding.
I mean, I get it because we have a lot of history.
Yeah.
You know, but I would imagine sometimes people, because I'll hear from students, they'll say, we're really intimidated. By no.
Yeah, the waitresses at Salt and Pepper used to tell me that. They used to say, your students are just in here. They're really scared of you. And I'm like, why?
Well, you don't know why they're scared of you?
Really.
I think part of you likes it.
I don't care about it. I just think it's fun. See, I used to be the good cop until Miles left.
Miles Stroth.
Miles Stroth used to teach Level 5. And he was brutal.
Like Dell brutal?
We're much worse than Dell.
Okay.
Dell wasn't trying to be brutal. He just didn't suffer fools at all. He didn't care about anyone's feelings. He would say, you know, get the fuck off the stage. You're ruining it for everybody else. You
and
know,
then they'd leave and cry.
And they'd leave and cry. Miles was like a drill sergeant. And then I'd get them. And then all of a sudden, I thought I was doing exactly what I do now. But everyone was like, oh, God, good cop. You know, so nothing's really changed except Miles leaving.
Right, but
that's what we've lost.
I just want to say this: Do you remember the old days? You could make people really cry.
I was a lot meaner when I started.
Yeah.
But I think we were all meaner when I started.
Yeah.
We were because we didn't care about each other's feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't say that meaning to be callous. It's just like we just didn't have time to care about each other's feelings. It is what it is. And now, because. You know everybody. Half the students have already been hanging around the building for a year, so you know them by face. They're not so anonymous. You're not trying to get. You don't want them crying. It's just a pain in the ass.
But I remember you said something to me that was really interesting. I got 5 or 6 years ago. You're like, you know what? It's kind of cool being the elder statesman of improv.
I said that.
You said that to me.
What was I smoking?
I don't think you were smoking anything. So you don't remember saying that?
We had 5 years ago? No, I don't remember any of it.
Do you consider yourself an elder statesman?
I consider myself elder.
Okay. Okay. All right.
It's fun being around for a long time. You know, but that's mostly personal failure.
Okay.
But
what do you enjoy about it?
Just seeing the new people come through is fun. You know, there's always really good people. It's fun watching them grow up.
We're gonna improvise, okay?
Okay.
We're gonna take a suggestion.
Yeah, I know how this goes.
Okay, great. You're such a smartass, aren't you? Can we have a suggestion, please?
Fake plant.
Now I do this to all the guests. You're probably gonna find some sarcastic way to knock it down. When you hear fake plants, how do you process that in terms of the suggestion?
That it's because of this.
Okay.
But
how do you use it?
I probably would think of a place where fake plants are and not talk about them.
Okay.
You know, like a movie theater lobby or a corporate, you know, hallway or something like that.
Okay.
Let's not use either of those because I said them.
Okay. Are you really? We won't.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's
great.
Go somewhere else.
Okay. Great. I think this key is going to open this door.
All right, I'll try it.
Okay.
It's not going to have an alarm on, though. Clearly not. It's good.
No, there it is. I got some blankets in here.
I appreciate you letting me hang out here.
Hey, no problem.
You act like you don't really have permission to be here with a key in it. Really.
No.
You told me it was fine for me to crash in the basement.
Yeah, no. Margaret.
Things aren't going well with Margaret?
No, they're not. But
you look afraid.
I am, because if she finds out that you're down here, she's going to be totally pissed off at me.
How do you think I feel?
Well, I just want
to... Now I'm breaking into your house, or your wife's house, apparently, against her will.
Well, I mean,
I'm raping your house.
Roger, don't be using that kind of language, okay? Especially around a 3-year-old, okay? All right.
She's down here.
Hey. All right.
Did you think I was going to violate your face?
I smell. Yes, I do. I smell beer on your breath, all right?
I was drinking beer and it's on my breath.
Well, it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It's 3 o'clock in the afternoon. All right, so here's the deal.
You can just told me about yourself. He said it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
What did I?
How you've changed, man.
Look, I'm not going to get high with you. I'm not going to go to a Cubs game. You can crash here for a couple days, and then you got
to
move on.
But I have to stay here unnoticed in the room with your baby. Margaret's not going to saunter down here to check on the baby during the time I'm here.
Well, here's the thing.
Just a plan.
Why do you have to be a smartass? Okay. Why can't you just be appreciative that?
Look, I appreciate it.
How many other people have allowed you to come into their house?
Listen, the fuck up those blankets.
All right.
We've got shoe dirt on them now.
All right. Here, Roger. Look, if you sleep behind this couch, when Margaret comes in, she's not going to see you. All right. Damn it. Sometimes, man, I don't understand. What?
You want to go out and get some branches and put them over me?
No, I don't want to get branches.
Obviously. You want me to hide?
Your humor is so dry. It's just like in college. Here's a pillow. Putting it over there.
All right.
And don't go into this. I'm locking this for a reason.
What's in there?
It's none of your business, all right? It's our wedding photos. I want to come here and see you, like, spread them out and make fun of them. And,
yeah. That's what I want to do. You've been told that you can't even go in there and look at those wedding photos.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah. So
right?
What? Yeah.
You just broke into your own closet.
Well, you know what?
Against the will of Margaret.
Look, Margaret loves me. All right.
Does she?
Yeah, she does. Don't
it's
get
a weird
my
way
head.
To start.
Don't get in my head to try to.
A lot of guys would say, I love Margaret. Margaret loves me like it's a sentence.
You're not going to try to fuck with my head, okay?
All right. You don't need me to fuck with your head.
Roger.
Your head is more fucked than Madonna.
I live in a house, Roger. You have nowhere to live. Right now in your life, you are homeless.
I shouldn't be taking high status when I'm bumming a basement. Right?
Yes, exactly.
I can't help it because you're such a fucking doormat. You're afraid of your own house. You're afraid of looking at the pictures of your own wedding because you're not allowed to.
It's not that I'm not allowed to. We just haven't agreed upon it yet.
Wait, what?
We haven't agreed upon it.
We have a meeting for this?
Yes. We have a meeting and we have set an agenda, and when it comes up in the agenda, probably in a couple months, we will discuss it. We have a roof to fix. We have a vacation we're going on.
Vacation from?
From our life. Okay. That's what people do, okay?
Yeah.
You probably think this is a vacation, don't you, Roger? Well, I'll tell you, it is not. It's you bumming a place to stay.
I'm unhappy about, having my, door padlocked.
And why is the door padlocked?
Because I didn't pay the rent.
Exactly.
I knew it was coming, but there was really nothing I could do about it.
You couldn't go and get a job?
I barely had beer money.
You always have beer money.
You can find beer money when you need it.
Yeah.
But I'm not happy about it. I mean, I would be embarrassed if you weren't so embarrassing. You know what I mean? I came here thinking I was going to feel shitty, and I feel great about being homeless now because I'm not married to Margaret. And I don't have anything against Margaret other than the way you seem to
feel. You
know
what? Margaret likes you. No. She likes you.
I don't have anything against Margaret, but I just don't think you love her.
Okay. Maybe I don't, all right? But I'm happy.
Really?
Yeah.
You're going to stand there and look me in the eye and say you're happy.
I am happy.
Your hand shakes when you go to open your own closet.
I am happy, all right?
Okay. If you've convinced yourself of that. I'm not happy, but I'm all right.
You know what?
I'm not terrified of being homeless. I'm going to figure something out.
You always do.
Yeah. Start at the bottom again. You got nowhere to go from up. We'll work at a gas station. How are they? Can that be? Those people are all idiots.
We're, you know what? We're going to Hawaii in a couple months. We're going to be happy.
Yeah. Hawaii makes every marriage work.
That's what it said in the brochure. So, stay away from her.
Okay. She's really going to be down here with me?
She's going to be down here with you.
I snore like a freight train and make other noises when
I'm asleep. Having a dinner party, and she needs to stay down here.
You're having a dinner party?
Yes. And I would really...
Well, what are you having?
We're having lamb.
Are you going to fix me a plate? Bring it down?
Yes, I'll fix you a plate.
Lamb, though, huh?
You have nowhere to live, and now you're getting choosy on what to eat?
I'll eat anything.
Okay. So I want you to watch. I want you to watch Connie, all right?
So now I'm babysitting.
You're babysitting, yes.
Before you would let me rock her.
I don't want you to touch her. I want you to just watch her.
Let's say she goes off.
Then I want you to call me on my cell phone, and I'll come down. I don't want you touching her.
What am I going to call you with?
I'm going to give you my cell phone. Okay?
How are you going to answer your cell phone?
You are going to text me to Margaret's phone. All right?
Okay, this plan is fraught with failure. Can you just pick her up and bounce her a little bit?
No.
She should call me uncle. Because, you know, we're practically like brothers from college. We're fraternity brothers.
That does not mean we're blood-related uncles, okay?
I had uncles I called uncle that I wasn't related to. They worked with my dad.
All right, fine. That's not how we work it in my family. Okay, all right, enough, okay?
I'm just looking at
Stay
her.
Over. Stay, she's playing with Legos, she's
okay,
fine.
I'm mixed messages. Am I watching the kid, or am I hiding from her?
You are watching the kid, all right?
You ever play with Legos? You take all the twosies out? Swallow those twosies. They're dangerous for kids.
We've discussed it. She's not going to swallow the twosies. Okay?
What happens if there's a tie? What's the tiebreaker when you guys vote? Or you just talk until she tells you what it's going to be?
Look, I'm not gonna fall for it, okay? What we do if there's a tie is that we flip a coin.
Boy, you can save yourself a lot of time. Start with that.
Okay, I'm going up to the dinner party.
I'm waiting down here. Are you going to bring me down a plate?
I will bring you down a plate.
I don't care what's on. There's no zucchini.
Okay, there'll be no zucchini.
I have a gag response.
Oh, I understand.
Anything in the squad.
I understand, but you had that in college.
I'm not going to play with the baby. If she cries just a little bit, I might rock her just a little bit. I'm not going to hurt her that way.
As long as you don't physically touch her.
I think the worst possible thing is for me to text Margaret for you.
Okay, here.
I think that's pretty much the jig is up as far as me being here.
If she needs to be rocked, I want you to do it with a stick. All right?
I'm giving you this so you can feel like you have some control.
Thank you. And scene. Great job.
That's fun.
What'd you like about it?
You
don't like analyzing.
The way you carried me. No. It was fun. You know, I had no idea where that was going to go.
Mm-hmm.
And that was fun, you know. I got to be a little bit of an asshole, which is always fun, you know. I don't think I was a total asshole, but I was kind of giving you, pushing your buttons.
Right.
And that's always fun, you know.
Do you like to break down a scene and deconstruct and go, hey, we could have done this? Or
one that I was just in?
Yes.
No.
Why is that?
It's a sand painting.
Meaning?
You put the work into making it, and then the wind blows it away. And I'm
so
done
then
with it.
How do you get better? So you do a scene like this. It goes pretty well. How can someone get better?
You can't. No, you get better by, you know, in classes, in rehearsals, there's a certain amount of analysis that you can act on right away. I think that's the difference. Like, if we're having a rehearsal, we do an opening, and we're all just kind of, God, that was awful. Why was it awful? Well, we just didn't forward it. We were just imitating each other's whooshing noises and basically selling it out and pussing it out. That reminds me, take a leap of faith, try something, go to turn the page, etc., push the ball forward. And then you can do it again right away and feel what it, get that, because you always know what to do, and when you don't do it, you're like, fuck, why didn't I know what to do? And then you do it again, so you feel what that muscle feels like to get it right, by doing a couple of reps and moving on. I've always found notes after a show to be about the most useless thing in the world.
So let me ask you this, because we were on Carlin Pearson. I'm not going to name the guy who did it, but we would have note sessions that lasted longer than the show. Do you remember this?
We had a couple, but you were only in Carlin Pearson for a short time, so
yes.
I can't remember whether it was Pat or Piero when you were there.
Okay.
Was it one of those?
It was
two?
The second one.
Okay.
And I love the guy, and he had a lot to say, but those note sessions went on forever.
Yeah, and I think that's part of like learning to be a coach is when you hire someone to be a coach, they want to, you know, earn their keep, so they do exhaustive notes. And some people love getting them as long as they're positive, you know, so it's that, you know, really? Do you really want me to tell you what you're doing wrong? I don't think you do. Showing up, you know.
But how did you get through that? Because they would go on for a long time.
I just listen because it's not like they're not insightful.
Right.
It's just there's absolutely nothing I can do with that information because it's going to be like a week till we play again, and I say, well, how can I fix a scene I already did that I'm not going to do the same thing again the next week? So probably the same note isn't going to apply. You know what I mean? When you're doing something repetitively, like in a class type of situation, you can focus on something, and it's usually something kind of broad strokey. And then there's people live for personal evaluation. I really don't. I think the only way to get better is to get to a place where you're trusting your instincts, so you're not thinking about improv while you're improvising. I was never thinking about where's this scene going to go when we were doing it. What's coming in 10 minutes? Who's going to play Margaret? You know, I wasn't thinking about anything but just this is right now. And I don't think, boy, that was the best scene anyone here has ever seen. It was fine, you know, it was fun. It's got to be instinctive, or else you're going to just keep missing the bus and getting in your head, as they say.
Great. So let's talk. We're going to get some questions from the audience.
All right.
If you've got a question, just put your hand up for Noah. Yeah, Dan.
I mean, you've been doing improv for so long. Does it ever get exhausting? Have you ever, like, burned out from it?
Do you ever burn out from improv, Noah?
Not so far, but again, because nobody's paying me to do it, I can take a night off anytime I want to. I don't need sick days. Just don't show up. You know?
But you're doing it like 3 or 4 times a week.
Yeah.
Which is pretty much 25 years ago, that's when you as much as you were doing it.
Yeah, yeah. And then there's times when I'm doing it 8 times a week. The only thing that makes me not do it, you know, 7 nights a week, because I got classes 3 days a week, and I don't really want to teach during the day and then perform that night, because I'm bored of my own voice by the end of a class.
But you also told me, you probably don't remember this either, but there's a balance. You don't want to be teaching too much improv, and you don't want to be to find that balance, because if you're teaching too much and you're performing, it affects your improv. You're rolling your eyes.
No, I'm sure I said that, and I'm sure I meant it at the time. But that's the other thing I like about improv. It's impermanent, as are my opinions about it. That's why I've never written a book. I don't think I'd still believe what I said by the time I finished it.
All right, so let's take another question. Great, right over here. What's your name?
Taylor.
Hey, Taylor.
I was just wondering, you guys have been around for a long time, or a while, and wasn't it that you don't see very often and you wish you saw more of it?
What would you like to see more of in improv?
I would like to see more people open themselves up to the possibilities of slower comedy.
I think that's a tough one when you're 22. And I think there are things that can happen to your mind in what we what Dell used to call slow comedy, what Jimmy's book's about, that if you're impatient, you'll never get to experience. And it's a whole there's a whole different level when you're taking your time that to me has a, has an energy, but it's potential energy. It's the tensions of a moment that it's probably most like what acting is like for actors and when they're really feeling it's happening. I'm saying that out of my ass because I don't know anything about acting. I've just gotten to do a little bit of it, you know, sort of on the side. I'm in SAG, but I can't act. But I think some the focus of the moment that's there, and you know you can sense it when you're watching TJ and Dave. When Jimmy used to do a show with Stephanie Weir, who some of you might know or have seen her on when she was on Mad TV for a while. That was called Naked. That was just an hour doing one scene for an hour. That was also had a lot of that going on. And I think, you know, again, I have no problem with running around and hooting improv either. But I think every practitioner of it should find their patient place as well. Not hesitant or complacent, but the focus of slow comedy can be quite a drug, and it's a high you want to get back like heroin.
Great. Another question? Right here? What's your name?
Hey, how's it going?
What's your name?
I'm Sam. How are you doing?
Hi, Sam.
I was wondering if there's any ways to improve upon your abilities as an improviser when you're not necessarily on the stage or in class, like just everyday life, like skills that you can bring there.
How can you work on being an improviser during your everyday life?
Unplug. You know, walk in the street without your earbuds in and pay attention to how people act, to what things look like, what it's like to hold things. Be aware and receptive as you walk through a day sometimes when the computer's shut off, when you're not listening, when you're not scoring your life with somebody else's music, but just the music of the world is what's carrying you through it. And being really present when you do that, your ability to visualize, visualization is really important on stage. Otherwise, you just start being a mime. And there's a difference between object work and miming, but this isn't a class, so we're not going to get too deep into that. But I think that's one way.
Great. Another question? Right over here.
This might be a little weird, but after a Doug Close passed away, did you feel any pressure to fill that void from other people or from sort of in the industry of that state?
Because you, Dell dies, and then you fill in for him.
Yeah.
Okay. Did you feel any pressure filling in for Dell?
No, not really. I mean, I didn't really feel that. Well, first of all, it would be absurd to imagine that I was filling in for Dell in my mind, right? I can't do what Dell did. Dell probably can't do what I did either. But obviously, I had a different relationship to the work than Dell because I was doing it. And Dell had long since stopped doing it. I don't know if he ever actually did a Harold, you know what I mean? And I'd probably done, you know, 100 of them by the time I taught my first class, at least. So no, I didn't feel that pressure. I suppose if I'd thought about it, I would. But I don't deal well with stress, so I just don't think about things that deeply.
Great. Another question? Right here? What's your name?
David.
Hey, David.
It seems like improvisers are more worried about reps and just going to shows to see shows. Like, how much value can you put in an improviser going to a show just to watch other improvisers with no stake in it, just to see it?
How important it is to go to see shows?
I think it's very important. I think the question implied probably that it was. It's nice to have people to kind of look up to when you're getting better at something too. And I think not people who are on a whole different plane, but like, oh, I can do that. I'm learning how to do that. Man, that, you know, Colleen Doyle really, you know, does a thing when she does a scene with Jason Schatz or whatever. What did they do there that I, you know, that I could learn from? Watching TJ and Dave. And we're watching a lot of people, watching Virgin Daiquiri, watching teams that have been around for a long time, going to the annoyance and watching people who are learning a slightly different spin on the same thing. I think it's valuable. I realize time is limited, but and reps are valuable. Reps can work both ways. You know, I think you can get into a niche improv situation where you reinforce somewhat complacent habits. You know, I know we used to probably have some of those in the early days when we knew everybody in the house and everything was an inside joke. You know, just like, I think it is important. I think it's important, but it's not like you should be at every show. But I think it's good. I think sometimes it's good to watch a show without an agenda other than remembering why you like it. You know, letting somebody make you laugh in a way that surprises you too.
You know, you mentioned Dave Pasquese, and he was the guy we looked up to. You know, is he, because in the first show, which we did not get recorded, you said that he was someone who you still wanted to impress. Is that still true?
Yeah, I'd say he's the person I look up to the most as a player. I mean, TJ's probably the best all-around player that I've played with. But he was the reason I started taking classes, was I saw him in a show. So, and I still, you know, that mind is just so impressive.
What makes him so good, you think?
Well, he's not afraid of his intellect. He's not afraid of the art of conversation. He's not afraid to take his time, and he's not that concerned about where the laugh is going to come from, if it's ever going to come. You know, he just trusts.
And what makes TJ the best person you've ever worked with?
Because it looks like Nichols and May. I mean, Dave just about only plays with TJ. TJ can play with anybody. You know, TJ will do any kind of show with anyone, any form. He's not afraid of form. A lot of very like senior improvisers get a little gun shy about form because they feel it limits their scenic breath. And TJ jumps into it with both feet, no matter what it is.
Great, we got time for one more question. Right here. Your name
Ross,
is?
Ross.
Hey, Ross.
You mentioned earlier about niche improvisation. Something that I've noticed happens a lot with people who are getting into improv is that they can sometimes find themselves in, you know, stagnating in the same form or style or whatever. What do you recommend for improvisers to sort of break up the monotony, like if they've been doing it too long?
What do you suggest? You're in a rut or you're in monotony. How do you break that up? Because you've been there. We've all been there.
Well, take some time off. Do something that isn't improv that works some similar muscles. You know, learn to play the piano, sing in a glee club. Yeah, I mean, well, stuff that takes different kinds of discipline, but those are all things that are going to be useful to you, having a better voice, being more precise with the math of things by getting into music, doing some scripted acting. You know, it's you get a whole new... There's nothing like a room full of improvisers doing an audition, and none of them can learn a page of sides. That just works some different muscles for you. And I think because the big theaters are tracks, you know, that you know, whether it's Second City's program, IO's, wherever, do some of your learning outside of the classroom process by working with a group that wants to work on something really hard, not with a goal other than to get better at it, a difficult form or a challengingly naked version of what they're doing that probably isn't going to have a high success as far as popularity, but you can get you can hone some skill, some of the purest skills of when you boil improv down to just listen and tell the truth. And the rest of it can go, you know. So, I mean, there's some things, and it's different for everybody. Some people need to stop for a while. Some people need to do something
you know, to make themselves really wanted again too, because you do, and I know half of you are currently in class with me. You're probably taking about your 50th improv class at this point, as far as weeks of it, and sometimes stepping off the boat and you know the stop and smell the flowers kind of thing isn't such a terrible thing to do.
Have you told people that have repeated 5B, couldn't get on a Herald team, to go, I think you should go somewhere else? Because that's...
I'm not comfortable turning away business. but when people ask me about it before they've gone ahead and done it, I usually tell them, I'm not a big fan of people just taking the same classes over and over again, because I think it gets to be kind of a I gotta get over this hump thing, which can get you in your head more than anything up to that point. You know, just go out and do some shows. I don't know, people come back after a couple of years, I don't give a shit. There are people who have taken 5B like 4 or 5 times. They're few and far between, but it's just, I'm almost exhausted to see them walk in the room. Not for any negative thing. It's like, what do you want out of this time, you know? It's just a weird situation.
We got to wrap this up. I got 2 questions. One is, how have you been able to make your relationship with Charna work for all these years?
I don't get in her business. I love her. She's one of my oldest friends. She is she's a tempest. She can blow your doors off. And you're not sure why. And so I just don't get it. I just stay out of the line of fire of all the politics at I.O. She asks me a question, I answer her, but I stay out of her hair, and hopefully she stays mostly out of mine.
And then what piece of advice would you give to an improviser starting today?
This is a tough one. Go till you realize whether or not you're good at it. Because loving it isn't a good enough reason to do it. Loving it is a great reason to watch it. Being good at it is a reason to keep doing it.
How is someone going to know that?
They're not. That's why it's terrible. It's terrible advice. They're going to have a series of people tell them that in one way or another until they start to believe everybody must be wrong. And they might get better. I mean, people get better, but I think you get to a point where you realize everything I do is making me a little bit better, or you're just frustrated and angry all the time. Why would you do something that makes you frustrated and angry all the time? I mean, that just seems like, kill yourself.
Let's end on that.
Kill yourself. Kill yourself.
Thank you so much. Noah Gregoropoulos, thank you so much for being our guest. And there you have it. Another episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. I want to thank my good friend Noah Gregoropoulos for being our guest. And I love improvising with him. It's always fun. We've always had really good... I don't think we've always had good chemistry, but we've developed it over the years. And I also want to... I love what he had to say about quitting improv at the end. And that's Noah. He's very wise and he's very honest at the same time. I'd like to thank Wes Humphreys here at Northwestern for putting this whole thing together, a special episode of Improv Nerd, and my producer here in Chicago, Dan Schiffmacher. He's the one who makes it sound so slick and so professional. Without Dan, you wouldn't be hearing my voice. And if you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning improv classes and workshops, like I said, on April 25th, I'll be offering an Artist Low Comedy 1-day intensive, and also my Improv Nerd blog and newsletter. Sign up today. Just go to jimmycorain.com. Also, we're taking over social media. We're doing this one social media platform at a time. Go to our Improv Nerd Facebook page and like us. It really helps with my low self-esteem. Follow us over on Twitter at improv_nerd, and then check out our YouTube channel. We're also on feralaudio.com. It's a podcast collective. It is some of the most innovative and unique podcasts out there. People like Dan Harmon and Todd Barry and Matt Dwyer and Steve Agee and Chelsea Peretti. The names go on and on.
I'd like to thank our two sponsors today, Under the Gun Theater and their improv boot camps. For more information on that, go to underthegunthéâtre.com. Also, the second annual Hartford Improv Festival. For tickets and full schedules, visit hartfordimprov.com. And of course, I want to thank you. I couldn't do this without you. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Hello, I'm Kyle Ayers. I'm the host of Never Seen It, the podcast where comedians rewrite famous movies and TV shows they've never seen, and then we give them a read in studio. This is a clip I want to play for you guys from an episode where Langston Kerman rewrites Scarface. He's never seen it, but he wrote a script based on what he thinks he knows about it, and here's a clip. Give it a listen.
All right, Scarface, The New Frontier. Interior, happening discotheque. Remember when we called clubs discotheques? LOL, the 70s were crazy. Night. The crowd bustles with young, hot Mexicans who are supposed to be Cuban and all are dressed in butterfly collared shirts and pants that look like JNCO jeans and pleated khakis had a really weird baby. There's sex in the air and Poppy wants a whiff.
Oh my God.
Scarface, 22 to 45.
Like he's a television audience demographic.
Devilishly handsome, not even a little bit Italian looking, so get that out of your dumb brain. Walks through the crowd with the confidence of a man who's going on MTV Cribs with the Ying Yang Twins one day. Does he actually have a scar on his face? Fuck no. Why would you even ask that? That's not important. What's important is that he is not at all a problematic stereotype and that he has come for his cocaine. As he approaches the red rope of the VIP, pronounced ve a pay in Spanish,
oh my God.
He spots his dear friend who is almost certainly going to become his enemy by the end of the film, Smooth Skin. Scarface yells out his signature line.
Ciao, Bella. It's me, Scarface.
Oh my